I'm Tom Guerin. I'm the Vice Provost for Faculty and Academic Affairs. I'd like to welcome you to the first patent lecture for the 2010-2011 academic year, featuring Jean Polizzikoff. In 1931, Mr. William T. Patton of Indianapolis made a gift of something more than $115,000 for the establishment of the Patton Foundation Lecture Series at his alma mater. At the time, it was the single largest gift ever pledged to the Bloomington campus. Under the terms of the gift, which became available upon the death of Mr. Patton in 1936, there was to be chosen each year a visiting professor who at the time was to be in residence 2 months or more of the year. The purpose of this appointment was to provide members of the university, students, faculty, and staff the privilege and advantage of personal acquaintances with the visiting professor. While those terms have changed over the years, we now typically have 3 patent lecturers spending a week each on campus. The spirit remains unchanged. A strong supporter of public higher education, Mr. Patton believed that private philanthropy was necessary to enhance its quality. He viewed his investment in the university in human terms, and in his own words, "Whenever you find Indiana University alumni, you find men and women who are taking an important place in the affairs of the community. College presidents, teachers, doctors, lawyers, business, professional leaders, homemakers." Patton believed that IU, still then a smallish and provincial institution, could enrich the intellectual life of the local community and of the state, both in the moment and in the future. He said, "I've always been proud to be a Hoosier. I'm proud to be a graduate of our great Hoosier State University, where we train and educate our children." Patton was born in 1867 on a farm in Sullivan County, Indiana. He taught in the county schools before enrolling at IU at the age of 21. He was a diligent student, competitive order, associate editor of the Indiana Student Paper. He received his undergraduate degree in history in 1891. After graduation, Patton settled in Indianapolis, where he made a career, presumably a good living, in real estate and also dabbled in county politics. The Patton lectures continue to reflect his commitment to Indiana education, and so far we have had almost 200 Patton lecturers on campus and counting. Campus-wide faculty committee selects people of national and international reputation who are also willing and able to share their knowledge with a wide public audience. Lecturers stay on campus for 1 week, during which time they interact with faculty and students in classes and informal gatherings delivered to public lectures. For tonight's program, I'd like to give thanks to several people, primarily the two nominators, Sarah Pryor and Rebecca Barthelme from Atmospheric Sciences. In addition, they wrote the primary nominating letters. The support letters came from a variety of offices and departments, including the Office of Sustainability, Departments of Geography, Geological Sciences, Kelly School of Business, Department of Physics, School of Informatics and Computing, School of Public and Environmental Affairs, Center for Research in Energy and Environment, and the Department of Biology. And for logistical support, we thank the Hutton Honors College, the Wells Scholars Program, the Cox Research Scholars Program, Provost Karen Hansen and her office, and I'd like to thank Inner Mohan Virk, who works in our office and is the director of the Patton Foundation series and organizes all of this. And now, without further ado, to introduce our distinguished visitor, Rebecca Barthelme.
Thank you very much. Jean Polizzikoff is currently a professor and founding director of the National Climate Change Adaptation Research Facility at Griffith University in Australia. Professor Polizzikoff won't mind, I'm sure, if I attempt to grab just a bit of the limelight here and tell you that I was one of her students. I have been really profoundly and positively impacted by Jean's thorough but kind of no-nonsense approach to climate science that really includes such a diversity of approaches, but also it has a commitment to quality, to upholding the quality and integrity of climate science. And I think this was a key asset when Gene led Working Group 2, Impact, Adaptation and Vulnerability, of the fourth assessment report for the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change when she led that from the UK Met Office. So when I was Jean's PhD student, it was back when Jean was a professor at the School of Environmental Sciences and a director of the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia in the UK. She was part of a really pioneering team that developed climate science and made it into the force that I think it is today. And I'm therefore really delighted that we've been able to bring Jean to Indiana University as one of our pattern lecturers to recognize her contribution to this important, this critical science. So I'd ask you to join me in welcoming our pattern lecturer for this evening, who is a Nobel laureate. So I'd like us to welcome Jean Palutikof, who's going to present the lecture, The Role of International Treaties in Tackling Climate Change. Thank you.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and I'd just like to begin by saying how very pleased I am to be here and how nice it is to be in Indiana when the weather is so beautiful and the autumn colours are so splendid, because as you can imagine, in Australia, which is full of eucalyptus forest, you don't get a lot in the way of autumn colours. So it's a great pleasure to be here, and it's a great pleasure and a privilege to be undertaking the pattern lectureships. I'm very flattered by the introduction from Rebecca and very grateful that she didn't mention any dates, but it is a considerable time since she was my PhD student, and I have to say the fact that she's now a professor in Indiana makes me feel quite old, but there you go.
Can we hear at the back?
Can you hear me? At the back.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So tonight I'm going to address the issue of the role of international treaties in tackling climate change. So this just reflects a little bit on the career that I had after I left the University of East Anglia, and when I undertook the job of being the head of the technical support unit for Working Group 2. And I'm just going to reflect a little bit around what's happening on the international stage with respect to managing the impacts of climate change and trying to reduce our emissions. And just seems an appropriate thing to be doing at this particular point in time when there is definitely a hesitation around international action for climate change. Tomorrow night I'll be addressing some thoughts around climate change adaptation, which relates much more to the job I currently do in Australia. So let's see how we go here. And let's begin by just thinking a little bit about the terms that we're going to use here tonight when we're thinking about climate change, because two things that are often confused in people's minds and in people's thinking and in the way they talk around climate change: you have to do something to deal with climate change, and basically if you're not into geoengineering and doing strange things like blowing aluminium foil into space to try and reflect the heat from the sun or dropping iron filings into the ocean, then you've actually got two weapons in your arsenal. One is mitigation and one is adaptation. And people talk about these terms rather loosely, but they do have quite distinct meanings. So mitigation is the action of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in order to avoid the threat of dangerous climate change. And you've got a picture there of a solar collector in Spain, which is generating electricity from the sun. Adaptation is essentially what you do when your mitigation fails. So if you can't actually act, and it's very clear, I think, to everybody now working in the community that we're never going to be able to act fast enough and to a sufficient extent to manage the threat of climate change, then what's left to you is adaptation, and that's dealing with the climate change that we haven't been able to mitigate away. And one of the weapons that you have for that, and hence the picture that you see here, is plant breeding programs in order to develop crops, food crops or commercial crops, which are better adapted to a changing climate. So, then, just having defined some terms, let's just set the scene a little bit. And you often hear people talking about whether or not they believe in climate change. And I have to say, I'm normally a very philosophical and phlegmatic person. If there's one thing that you want to say that will really enrage me, it is to tell me that you either believe or you do not believe in climate change. Because this is not a faith system, this is science. So if you take one message away from this talk tonight, you can go now, because the message is, don't ever say again that you believe in climate change or you do not believe in climate change. What you can tell me is that you've assessed the science, and on the basis of the assessment, and it can be a thorough assessment or just a, you know, reading The Economist or the New York Times or whatever is your fancy, you know, on the basis of your assessment of the evidence, it is your considered view that climate change is a reality or not. You know, you're entitled to your position. But I don't really think that you should be going around saying that you believe or you do not believe in climate change. But that's just my rant for the evening, and now I'll settle down and tell you something a little bit more sensible about climate change. So, one of the things that people will often say when they're trying to be critical about climate change is, oh, well, you know, it's something that just come up in the last few years. It's just a way that scientists have of extracting money from the system, and they're just being really cynical and playing this for all they can get, and in a couple of years it'll have blown over and they'll be worrying about something else. Well, that isn't true. The history of climate change and scientific thinking around climate change goes back rather a long time. And scientists normally trace it back to a guy called Svante Arrhenius, a Swedish gentleman who in 1895 gave a presentation to the Stockholm Physical Society on the topic of the influence of carbonic acid in the air upon the temperature of the ground. And really, that was the first time that anybody had really flagged it up in a serious way. It didn't really set people alight. At that time, people were getting out into the countryside. They had leisure time. They were thinking about the landscapes that they lived in. And in particular, in Northern Europe, they were thinking about glaciations, ice ages. Why does the landscape look the way it does? Why do you get U-shaped valleys? Why do you get moraines? And there was that sort of combination between climate science and landscape science or geomorphology that was leading to some very fascinating developments around the understanding of ice ages and interglacial periods. And no one really was worrying about anthropogenic effects on our climate, warming produced by our industrial activities and by burning of forests. But around about 1938, a rather handsome Englishman appeared called Guy Callender, who published 10 major scientific articles around global warming. And at that time, he thought that warming would be beneficial because it would delay a return of the deadly glaciers. So you can see there was still this thinking around ice ages. So that just gives you a little bit of a history, and it just tries to show you that there is a backstory around climate change. It's not something which has just appeared on the science horizon in a rather cynical attempt to extract money from the system. It is something with rigorous scientific roots. But neither Arrhenius nor Callender had the kind of resources that we have today to explore climate change. And if people tell me that they are critical and uncertain of the evidence which we have around climate change, then there are a couple of pieces of evidence that have become available to us because of the availability of high-speed computing, which we didn't have in the past. And the first of these is the observed global land and sea temperature record, which extends from around about 1850 and is continually updated and just demonstrates a very clear and unremitting progression of warming over time. So this is the combined land and sea temperature record, and it's right up to date, and it tells you that 2009 was the sixth warmest on record, and that 14 of the 15 warmest years have now occurred in the past 15 years. And my understanding is that 2010 is actually heading to be the warmest year on record. It doesn't change. Year on year, you have this progressive increase over time that as the evidence accumulates, we really have to face up to the fact of the reality of global warming and the acceptance of the underlying causation, which is our own ability to change the atmosphere through our behaviour. Linked to that, and if you live in Australia like you do, you do begin to see trends in the rainfall record. So this is the annual total rainfall record for Australia for between 1900 and 2008. So it shows you the trend over time between 1900 and 2008, and it looks fairly innocent. But if you begin to look more at the more recent period, so this is a period 1950 to 2008, you can begin to see some trends developing, and those trends are not decreasing, they are remaining. So this is a very recent period from 1970 to 2008, and you can see that over eastern Australia and southwestern Australia, there's a very clear drying trend, and over northwestern Australia, the Kimberleys and the Pilbara, there is a trend towards increasing rainfall in those western tropical latitudes. And Australia is, analysis of the record by Australian scientists suggests that particularly in the southwest region around Perth, for those of you who have a little geography of Australia, there's a clear relationship between the drying trend and anthropogenic influence, human influence on the atmosphere. The second piece of evidence, so the first piece of evidence lies in the observational record, comes to us because we have the ability to process very quickly very large amounts of data, so you can collect together all the temperature and rainfall records from around the globe and you can process them to look at the trends over time. The second piece of evidence which comes to us because we have high-speed computers is the ability to build models of the atmosphere in those computers and then change the concentrations of the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere of those climate models and then look out into time, go forward in time to look at how the climate changes. So you simulate the Earth atmosphere system in your computer and then you change the concentrations of the greenhouse gases and you see what happens over time. So in the left-hand graph you can see how the emissions of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide are changed in the model, and on the right-hand side you can see how the temperatures change in the model in response to those changes in the greenhouse gases. So there are various, so you can see up to the year sort of 2003-2004 in this particular graph, that's the observed record varying over time, and then as soon as the colours change after about 2003, that's the model simulation. And you've got different lines because people visualise the a number of different ways in which we might live out into the future. So if you look at the upper red line, that's based around a scenario where we all carry on exactly the way as we do today, with cheap fuel, cheap energy, people having lots of motor cars, driving them everywhere, generating our electricity from coal and oil. So really going for the complete consumption of greenhouse gases. And if you look at the dark blue line, which is the third one down, that's what you get if we try to behave in a more sensible, greener fashion. So there are various explorations of how temperatures will change, but basically the computer models estimate that by 2100 or so, global temperatures will increase by between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees centigrade. That range remains pretty constant. You know, for all the work that's been done with the computers, that range has remained pretty constant over time. And actually, Arrhenius and Callender, although they didn't have access to high-speed computers, all they had was the back of an envelope, weren't far off. Arrhenius' estimate for the end of the current century was between 5 and 6 degrees, and Callender's estimate was 2 degrees. So they came pretty close to the best guess that our models in computers have today, which is between 1.5 and 4.5 degrees. Right, so that completes a bit of a background around what I want to say. But there is a widespread recognition amongst governments that we need to do something about climate change. So despite the activities of the climate change deniers, governments globally have come together to try and discuss, debate, and take action around climate change. And that coming together of governments is encapsulated in an organisation called the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Now, the wording's a little bit odd. So there is a convention around climate change, which was negotiated and signed by most countries at the Rio Summit in 1992, which entered into force in March 1994. And its mandate is to consider actions to reduce global warming and to manage whatever temperature increases are inevitable. That convention has an organization based in Bonn in Germany, also known as the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which provides the managerial bureaucracy to make what is called the UNFCCC work. The main instrument of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, in order to make mitigation happen, so that is to reduce global emissions of greenhouse gases, is something called the Kyoto Protocol. And the Kyoto Protocol sets up binding commitments. It was adopted in Kyoto, hence its name, in December 1997. And it entered into force in February 2005 when Russia signed the protocol. So the protocol came into force when governments which are responsible for half of global emissions signed the document. And as Russia came into the Kyoto Protocol, that tipped the balance so that the signatories represented 50% of global emissions of greenhouse gases, and so the protocol entered into force then. It's a rare example, I'm told, of a successful introduction of a binding multilateral regime. I think, you know, successful might be a little bit of a strong word, given what's been happening recently around the Kyoto Protocol, but I'll tell you about that in a moment. So, the problem for the Kyoto Protocol is that it's time-bound. And the first commitment period for the Kyoto Protocol ends in 2012. So, what to do? The UNFCCC, the Framework Convention on Climate Change, holds annual conferences of the parties, where the parties are the signatories to the Kyoto Protocol. And the purpose of those meetings, which go on for 2 weeks and take place usually over the November-December period somewhere, is to negotiate action around the Kyoto Protocol, so to see who's done what, who's prepared to do what, who's meeting their commitments, who's failing to meet their commitments, what action should be taken against those governments which are failing to meet commitments, etc., etc., etc. And at the end of 2009, The 15th Conference of the Parties was held in Copenhagen. To a tremendous amount of prior publicity, far too much. The expectations around COP15 in Copenhagen were far too large at the time that the meeting opened. The purpose of Copenhagen was to put in place a successor to the Kyoto Protocol, i.e. a post-2012 mechanism for reducing emissions of global greenhouse gases, and to develop a roadmap to get the governments from COP15 at the end of 2009 through to 2012, when the successor to the Kyoto Protocol would come into being. It came, as I said, and the meeting itself opened to a great fanfare of publicity, huge expectations raised by the Danish government that this would be a breakthrough meeting, when there would be a real meeting of minds in Copenhagen to develop a way forward for the world. And the meeting failed abysmally, leaving the international process in limbo, which is where we sit today. So it's worth just spending a little time to consider why the meeting in Copenhagen failed. And the basic reason is that is around the fact that the Framework Convention process, round, like all United Nations processes, is built around the principle of one country, one vote. And the big emitters, the currently big emitters and the future big emitters, are no longer prepared to accept external policing of their affairs by organisations like the Framework Convention on Climate Change. And when I say the big emitters, I mean the United States, yourselves, plus what are sometimes known as the BRIC countries, which is future big emitters, Brazil, Russia, India, China, or with the failure of the Russian economy now, sometimes it's called the basic group of countries, which is Brazil, South Africa, India and China. And you can see in the little table on the right how these countries stack up, with China now responsible for the highest percentage of global emissions, closely followed by the United States, and then a little bit further behind the European Union. And you can see this represented on a map. So this shows you the carbon dioxide emissions, so not all greenhouse gases, but carbon dioxide in particular, from fossil fuel burning, total emissions by country. And you can see who the bad guys are, yourselves. China would be another one, and then coming up in a rather secondary league, India and Russia, and then you can see South Africa and Brazil there with a little bit of way to go. You can show this a different way, just so you'll feel a little bit better. So this shows you the greenhouse gas emissions. So now this is, because I couldn't get completely comparable maps when I went hunting for them, this is actually for all greenhouse gases, so not just carbon dioxide, but also nitrous oxide and methane, for example. This shows you emissions per capita. Now you can see this is a slightly out-of-date map, because actually now Australia has gone past the United States, and on the last set of statistics I saw, the largest carbon footprint, now the prize belongs to Australia. And the United States is in second place, so sorry, chaps. Not that it's necessarily a prize you want to win. So the outcome from Copenhagen. So, as I said, the process in Copenhagen failed completely. So what did they come away with? Because it is a fact that none of these government representatives, when they come to these meetings, they don't want to go home and say to their bosses, "We failed. I come empty-handed, I have nothing." So they cobbled together something called the Copenhagen Accord, which has no formal standing in United Nations process. Under the Copenhagen Accord, countries can pledge reductions in emissions, which they self-police. Well, as you can imagine, that's not really going to get anybody anywhere, because I can say, right, okay, I'll cut my emissions by 30% in the next couple of years and I'll self-police it. And it's not really much of a deterrent to know that the only people who are going to call you to account on this are your own people. there isn't going to be any international sanction on you to make sure that you meet your promises. So it isn't enough. And in fact, even if countries met their pledges, it's unlikely to avoid dangerous climate change, which is widely accepted as being warming greater than 2 degrees. And I'll come back to that in a little bit. It isn't the end of the story. As I said to you, these meetings are annual, so there will be another meeting in a couple of months in Cancun. And next year, at the end of 2011, the governments will meet in Cape Town. Looks like the Cancun meeting is going to play out as mainly around adaptation, while they all take stock and relax a little bit and try to see where it is they stand. And maybe when they come back in Cape Town, they'll think some more around mitigation. But it's not a pretty story at the present time. Where does it leave us? Well, this tries to show you where we stand at the present time. So I'll probably show this graph a couple of times tonight. It shows you on the bottom axis warming of the global mean annual temperature from 0 to 5 degrees. And up the side, it shows you then various sectors of impact, water ecosystems. So the impact of a warming of, say, 1 degree on the water sector, on ecosystems. And I have a little pointer here. So see if I can make it work. So if you look, then this red line here, this orange line here shows you the impacts that would occur by 2100 if there were no reductions in emissions. If we all carried on the same way we're carrying on today, then this is where we would stand by 2100. Taking the pledges under the Copenhagen Accord that I've just spoken to you about would take us back to around about 2.5 degrees of warming by 2100. So the pledges that are on the table avoid this amount of impact here. Moves us back from this amount of warming to this amount of warming. If you then look at the amount of money that's on the table at these UN Framework Convention discussions for adaptation, that would manage this amount of impact shown here. So it wouldn't really help us to deal with ecosystems at all, but it would help us to deal with some proportion of the impact due on the water system from climate change. But it leaves us with a gap here. This is the impacts which are not avoided by the amount of money that's available for adaptation and the promises that have been made around mitigation. So as you can see, there is a gap. What happened in Copenhagen isn't sufficient for us to manage climate change successfully. So that's all I want to say really about the Copenhagen events, just to bring you up to date with where we stand, which isn't anywhere good. And now I'm just going to tell you a little bit about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change and its role in this, because you hear a lot said about the IPCC and some of that is misinformation, so I'd just like to dispel that this evening. So the IPCC was formed by UNEP, the United Nations Environment Programme, and the World Meteorological Organization. And its role was to provide assessments of the science of climate change in order to support the negotiations primarily of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. It has a responsibility to provide policymakers with objective findings. It should be an honest broker. And if you want to know what the relationship of the IPCC is to the UNFCCC, the Framework Convention, then that shows you how it operates. It exists to support, to supply the scientific evidence which governments need in order to support their negotiations around the Framework Convention. And just to show you a little bit how that works, I'm just going to take you through the process for the production of the fourth assessment report, which appeared in 2007, so that you can see that this is no fly-by-night operation. This is an operation which deeply involves the bulk of the scientific community around climate change working pro bono for a period of between 5 and 7 years to produce these assessment reports, which are extensively reviewed. So there are three reports, one for the physical science, one for impacts and adaptation, and one for mitigation. Each of those reports is of the order of 1,000 pages in length. Each of them is then condensed down into a summary for policymakers, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a summary for people who are not scientists primarily, in order that they can understand the main findings of the report. And the work is also condensed into a synthesis report of around about 50 or 60 pages, which tries to just set out the major findings of all three of the reports. This shows you the process, but isn't a particularly helpful graph and is just repeated here. So this shows you the process that was gone through by Working Group 2 for the fourth assessment and is gone through for all of the assessment reports. So it began way back in 2002 with the decision to produce a report. In 2003, an outline for the report was approved, and in 2004, the authors of the report were selected. And then the whole thing swung into action, and there is a process by which authors meet. They prepare a draft. The draft goes out for review, which is an international review, takes 6 weeks to complete. The authors then take the results of that review, they incorporate them into the writing of a new draft of their chapter, and then they come together to meet and agree the new draft. It goes out for review. So there's a continual cycle of writing and review, which goes around three times. So there's an informal peer review, which doesn't have any formal standing and is done by fellow scientists. Then there's a formal expert review, a formal review by experts and government representatives, and then a final review, which is done by governments alone. All those are done electronically, remotely. The review period is open for 6 weeks. Finally, everybody comes together in a big meeting somewhere for a week to agree the text of the summary for policymakers, which is this 15-page document which attempts to summarise everything in your report. How many people do you have working on that? Well, you have two co-chairs. You have something of the order of 50 coordinating lead authors, 125 authors, 45 review editors representing 70 countries, 900 expert reviewers to make sure that you're keeping true to the science, and a technical support unit which has the responsibility of managing the whole process through. So it's an elaborate process. This shows you the chapters that go into the report. They cover all sectors: freshwater ecosystems, coastal, industry, human health, all regions, and they also look at the responses to the impacts of climate change through adaptation and mitigation. So very comprehensive review of the science. But as I said to you, there is also a summary for policymakers, and this is the key to the whole process, because this summary has to be approved by governments on a line-by-line basis. And once the governments come together and approve the summary for policymakers, that means that the underlying report of 1,000 pages is accepted by those governments. This shows you what the approval meeting looks like. So the government negotiators sit on the floor. They come from all the governments who wish to be present and comment. They sit alphabetically, so United Republic of Tanzania has a misfortune to sit between the United States and the United Kingdom. I feel very sorry for that man. With the IPCC representatives on the podium of the meeting, and the text of the summary for policymakers is projected line by line and has to be approved by the government. And every time they approve a paragraph of text, the gavel goes down, it's approved, it then becomes a formal piece, or a formal declaration, essentially, by the IPCC around the climate science. How does that work? Well, that just shows you them all standing around negotiating. This is the United States representative, one of the negotiators from the United States, a man called Trigg Talley, and this is one of the UK representatives, David Warlow. And as you can see, then the Chinese here are very interested in what they have to say to one another. And that shows you the chair of the IPCC and the secretary looking delighted when a piece of text is finally accepted. And this gives you some idea of why they're so pleased, because this shows you a piece of text which appears in the published summary for policymakers of Working Group 2 and the Fourth Assessment in this form. This is the published text. It says, approximately 20 to 30% of species assessed so far are likely to be at increased risk of extinction if increases in global average temperature exceed between 1.5 and 2.5 degrees. Now, it's just informative, I think, to understand how that piece of text evolves. So I said to you there are three electronic reviews. When the text went into the final one of those electronic reviews, it looked like this. It said roughly 20 to 30% of species are likely to be at high risk of irreversible extinction if global average temperatures exceed between 1.5 and 2.5. On the basis of the comments received back from that electronic reviews, the technical support unit generated this piece of text, which was the text that was projected in the approval meeting to be discussed by governments. And you can see we show it in track changes so that the governments can see there's no funny business going on. They can see exactly what changes the technical support unit made. They can see the original text that's up here, and they can see what we are recommending the text should be to the governments. You can see how it's changed. So irreversible extinction has gone, which is probably a very good thing. What the government said is, what do you mean irreversible extinction? If it's extinct, it's extinct. And the scientists said, well, you know, what we mean is a global extinction, not a local extinction. And the government said, oh, don't be so silly. So the scientists took out irreversible, and I think, you know, the governments, they're sensible people, so sometimes the text is improved, and I think that's one example where the text did improve. But it's informative to look at how this piece of text changed around high risk. So some of the governments really didn't like that. They didn't like high risk. That really was a bit of an inflammatory statement. So we modified it to read committed to. And we projected this text at the approval meeting, and something like 5 hours later, this piece of text appeared here, at increased risk of extinction. So you can see how the governments can act to modify, and in this key case, dilute the statements that the scientists originally wanted. And this is one of the issues around the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change that I'll come to in a little while. But sometimes, you know, getting rid of irreversible extinction wasn't a bad thing to do. But the governments fought hard over this one, but the IPCC, the actual working group itself and the scientists also fought hard over this one, because it was considered an important piece of text, an important statement that had to be made. And after the approval meeting, which takes you 5 days and several nights, then, you know, the scientists have their moment in the sun and the newspapers carry nice articles about what's said in the IPCC, and everybody feels a little bit better. So I just want to spend a little bit of time now, as we draw towards the close, thinking about what it is that the IPCC has contributed over the, you know, 15, 18 years that it's been operating. And for me, there are three things that are important. One is around the evolving of the accepted science, because the summary for policymakers has the effect of an agreement between the science community and the governments around what is the science of climate change at that particular point, 2007 in this case. And the thing about it is that once it's approved, the governments who are the signatories to the Framework Convention and to the IPCC cannot deny that statement. It becomes a basis for negotiation, because essentially once it appears in the IPCC, it has been accepted by all governments, which gives it great power. So, as you will see in a moment, the IPCC has worked to evolve the accepted by government science. It's also helped us to understand what is dangerous climate change, and that's widely accepted now to be 2 degrees global mean temperature increase, although there's a little bit of wooliness in there because it depends what baseline you take, and governments are not always quite honest about what the baseline is. And then it's the further thinking about how that dangerous climate change can be avoided. So here's an example of how the IPCC has supported the evolution of science thinking. So this is around observed climate change and what the evidence tells us about global warming in the observational record. And in the first assessment report, there was, they said, insufficient observational evidence to make a statement around global warming in the observational record. In the second assessment report, the statement was made and agreed that the balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate. Tentative. In the third assessment report, it got a lot firmer. They really made a big jump from the second to the third assessment, which reported in 2001. Most of the observed warming over the last 50 years is likely to have been due to the increase in greenhouse gas concentrations. Good, real progress. In the fourth assessment, the progress was much less. Essentially, the only change was that likely moved to very likely, but otherwise the statement remained pretty much the same. So there was some progress, but a little bit less between the third and fourth assessment as things became a little more rocky. I also said that it helped us in our thinking. So that was one piece of, that was one contribution that the IPCC has made. The second is around the thinking on dangerous climate change. So the IPCC does a lot of work around understanding emissions scenarios and their effect on global temperatures. And I've already shown you this graph, which comes from the essentially from the 2001 assessment report. But that graph, so I've just shown you essentially this graph here. And I'm just going to show you that again here. It's the same, essentially the same graph. And against it, you see this chart, which was produced by Joel Smith and Steve Schneider in the United States. Steve Schneider was at Stanford, but very tragically died 2 or 3 months ago. A great thinker and a great communicator and a great loss to us all. They produced this graph which thinks about how severe the risks are to certain critical systems from global warming. So this is essentially, this bar here is essentially about ecosystems, and you can see that the yellow turns to red quite low down at about 1 degree. For extreme climate events, you've got a little bit more wriggle room. It changes from yellow to red at about 2 degrees, and so on for 5 different critical systems. This has been updated by Joel Smith and Steve Schneider. There's a more recent paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, but essentially it just changes the point at which the yellow turns to red. But just thinking around what is shown to you in these bars, the government's really fixed on the idea that 2 degrees, which just translates across at about this level, would be a level at which you would have to think dangerous climate change was taking place. And now, of course, you can work backwards with emission scenarios. So you can say, okay, so we accept that global warming will be 2 degrees Celsius. So what are the trajectories over time of emissions that would deliver a warming of 2 degrees or less? And that's the work, really, that the IPCC is undertaking now, or scientists associated with the IPCC. And this shows you the kind of evidence that you can pull out by saying, OK, let's work backwards. We want to keep warming below 2 degrees. So what trajectories of emissions would deliver warming, which is below the dangerous threshold? And what this tells you, this graph here, is that emissions have to reduce by about 50% by 2050 globally. And that requires a reduction by developed countries of 85% of their emissions compared to 1990. By developed countries, and by developing countries, there is no mandatory target for them here, but that they have to start reducing their emissions by around about 2020 if we're to keep below this 2 degrees threshold. So that's another contribution that's coming from the IPCC. Then finally, I said, the other contribution that the IPCC has made, which is a big and important addition to the science, is thinking around how the impacts change, specific to sectors, for different amounts of emissions reductions. And essentially, I've already taken you through this graph. This shows you the impacts for slightly over 4 degrees of warming, which is what we expect if emissions are not reduced. We just carry on the way we're doing, up to 2100. And this shows you what happens by 2100 if indeed we achieve 50% reduction of global emissions by 2050. So if we achieve the targets that was shown to you in the previous graph, we would actually manage to avoid all these impacts that are shown here for these various sectors. And there is a range of uncertainty on this figure, which I haven't shown for clarity, but the best guess is that we would avoid a warming of 2 degrees if we managed to hold our emissions to 50% of the 1990 levels by the time we get to 2020. But it's only 10 years away, so it's a big challenge. Okay, so we're coming to the end now, and just to say a little bit to summarise the strengths and weaknesses of the IPCC. So there are 4 characteristics of the IPCC, and each has a strength and each has a weakness. So it has a rigorous review process, which is carried out by scientists and governments, which means that each chapter is reviewed 3 times and should be extremely robust in its findings. But the problem there is that the elapsed time is rather great to complete an assessment, and that by the time you get to the end of the assessment, the science has moved on and you may be a little bit out of date. So that's one of the downsides. The approval process brings together governments and scientists to approve the summary for policymakers line by line. It's a good thing, because then the governments are stitched in to the key statements in the SPM. They've actually approved them, and they cannot deny them, because the IPCC is a consensus process. So it won't. That's why the approval process takes so long. It takes 5 hours to agree just a small paragraph of text, because all governments must be on side before the process moves on to the next paragraph. But that means, as I showed you very clearly there, that science is watered down. There is no doubt about that. What the IPCC does is an assessment of the science, and it is therefore perceived by the governments as unthreatening and impartial. Many people in the wider community widely misunderstand the IPCC, what the IPCC represents. They think it is more than that, but it is not. It is an organisation which provides an assessment of the literature. It always strives to be policy relevant, but never policy prescriptive. That's its mantra. Policy relevant, not policy prescriptive. Each assessment is largely freestanding. You do it for 7 years and you dismantle the team and you think about it for a while, and then if all the governments agree, you start up a new assessment. But each assessment is largely freestanding, which allows the organisation to review itself for every assessment, but means that the organisation lacks some corporate memory. So, final messages then. Well, where do we stand at the present time? Well, as governments hesitate, as they did in Copenhagen, the evidence for climate change mounts. So this year, in July and August, Russia, under a tremendous heat wave and drought, has banned wheat exports until the 2011 harvest to see whether that is good or bad, and then make a decision. Pakistan and China as well have both suffered catastrophic floods. The science is under threat. The IPCC is meeting in Korea as we speak to consider what the Inter-Academies Council have said about it and its processes in its recent report. But my final message to you would be, despite the fact that we stand in not a wonderful place at the present time with respect to action on climate change, the bottom line for me is that uncertainty does not justify inaction. So The Economist, which is not known as a particularly radical publication, is in fact a rather conservative publication, did a special issue on climate change on the 20th of March this year. And in it, it said, action on climate is justified, not because the science is certain, but precisely because it is not. And that is the message that I would leave with you tonight. Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. So I thought I'd just show you that I really did go to Auckland. It was fun.
Would you agree to take some questions?
I would, yes, if there is time. I'd be happy to.
I forget the specifics, but about a year ago or maybe a little bit longer, there was a big problem that arose because a number of climate scientists had seemed to squelch some doubters who had written some papers, and papers either didn't get to appear in the publications or were poo-pooed or something. And, of course, this was jumped on by a number of governments and so forth. What damage did that kind of a scenario do?
I mean, do you mean damage in terms of the robustness of the science, or no, damage in terms of the sort
the
of the publicity?
The overall publicity.
Tremendous.
And getting your message
tremendous.
Out.
It did huge damage. It contributed to the failure of the Copenhagen process, the meeting in Copenhagen. There is no doubt about that.
What were the specifics? Because I really don't remember the specifics about the episode.
They foolishly left their email archive on a server that was not behind the university firewall. So there's a moral to everybody sitting in this room, probably. Just be more careful with your emails. And it was... they were hacked, so somebody stole them essentially from the server and went through them. And people, I mean, it's changed for me the way I write my emails. And if I want to say something that someone might take a little bit contentious, I pick up the phone now. I don't say it in an email because I think it was a demonstration to all of us how insecure emails can be. So they said things like, the one that people really picked on was, so we'll use John's trick to process the data. And people fixed on the word trick. And really all they meant was, we'll use his little algorithm for making it look tidy. but it was widely described as an attempt to fix the data, really, to use the data to lie. I know the people involved, I don't believe for a moment they would have done that. But you've got to be careful these days. Yep.
A little over a year, President Obama induced your Prime Minister at L'Aquila, who then proceeded to explain that the global carbon capture and storage, CCS, facility was being constructed or assembled in Australia. And I just wanted to ask, how it is going? It was supposed to condense all the research findings from all the world and make them in turn available to all the world, so it was to be a hub of exchange as well as organizing research on CCS.
Carbon capture and storage around clean coal, because Australia has a very powerful coal lobby, exports very large amounts of coal to China, and also generates most of its electricity from coal. So it's investing billions into clean coal, and I think they've got a pilot project starting up sometime now. So it's going, they're doing it. I don't think it's the best use of their money, but it's not mine. Yes?
Why isn't the science served?
Sorry?
There are many reasons why
the science is uncertain. Where do you begin? You push your climate models are trying to understand what happens when you increase the concentrations of emissions. Greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, but at the same time you have natural variability going on in the climate. So the interaction of the forcing from the greenhouse gases and the natural variability makes it very hard to understand just exactly how much of the warming that you're seeing is, or you're projecting into the future, is due to increased emissions of the greenhouse gases, and how much is due to natural variability. So that's one reason. A second reason is that, Rebecca could probably talk much more convincingly around this, but carbon sinks are not properly understood. So the last time I looked, there is some actually missing carbon. Have they found out where that's going? So there's not as much carbon in the atmosphere as there ought to be, given what we're doing. So there is some missing carbon, and we don't properly understand how the carbon cycle works and where are the sinks for carbon. Where is it going if it's not in the atmosphere? You know, so is it going into the oceans? Is it going into the biosphere? Where is it? So that's another source of uncertainty. The relationship between how greenhouse gases are being emitted into the atmosphere and the effect that that has on the water vapor content of the atmosphere is also not completely understood. So there are some things that we don't properly understand. And then there are a whole bunch of uncertainties associated with how people will behave in the future. We might all get up tomorrow morning and say, that's it, no more motor cars for us. We're going to build wind turbines. We don't want anything to do with this carbon-based economy anymore. There is a chance, very small, that we will do that. And there are many different ways that we might live into the future. So that's another source of uncertainty, probably one of the biggest. And then there are differences that appear in the climate model. Some of them are less sensitive to the effects of adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere than others. So there are a whole bunch of uncertainties. They're well understood, but reducing them is tricky. Where do we go now? You choose.
Yes, could you just expand on what you meant towards the end? Your example of science under threat, the IPCC meeting in Korea. Could you just give us a little bit more detail on that?
As a result of all the ClimateGate, which was the leaked emails, and a statement in the Working Group 2 report around Himalayan glaciers, which was a mistake, it was decided that, but was a mistake in the chapter. It never appeared in the summary for policymakers, so nobody feels very badly about it in the IPCC, because it never carried forward into the policymaking arena. Nevertheless, it's a point of criticism, and it was a mistake. It was one mistake in a 2,000-page document. Only God is perfect, you know. But as a result of that, it was decided that there would be a review of the IPCC processes, which was done by the Inter-Academies Council. That reported a month ago, something like that. So the meeting that's taking place in Korea as we speak here is going through the recommendations from that Inter-Academies Council report and deciding what to do about them.
Steve Snyder was here a couple of years ago, and he expressed a lot of concern about positive feedback, particularly methane release in the Arctic. Could you comment on that? And is that known?
Yes, it is. And again, I mean, Rebecca's the person to speak on that because she's the atmospheric chemist and I'm not. Would you like to say something? Well, you can tell me if I'm wrong. I understand that it is still considered to be a serious threat. It's not only in the Arctic, there are also seabed methane deposits in deltas, so I think on the coastal shelf, so they're also a threat. You know, there are a whole bunch of feedbacks out there that could cause us terrible problems.
Is it fully treated in the models, or is it unknown at this point?
I don't think it's not in the models. It doesn't actually need to be in the models to make them operate properly. I don't know what would happen if you put them in. It would accelerate the warming. I don't know to what extent. No.
So the two biggest contributors to greenhouse gases are the United States and China currently. Very different political and economic systems. Can you comment on your sense of the trajectory of those two countries over the coming years or decades?
No. I can't. Your guess is as good as mine. In fact, rather better, because you're citizens of the United States and I have never lived in the United States.
Dr. Stewart and I have a paper out where we try to address the issue that you brought up in terms of shortcomings. The first one that you mentioned is that with the negotiated science through IPCC, there is the problem of the science moving on by the time the report is actually published. So we were suggesting that perhaps you could use something like a wiki in between the time of the reports are published as a way to keep the science updated. Maybe the wiki isn't open to everybody, but it's open to you as scientists, as among the 2,000 scientists who work on the panel, to continue to have that dialogue. What do you think of the prospects of something like that to keep the science fresh?
Depends on what role you think it would have in the negotiating process. The governments are extremely jealous and extremely protective of their role in the IPCC as, how would you describe it? You might describe it as gatekeepers almost, you know, so they won't see, it could have no standing because it had not been reviewed by governments. That would be the bottom line for the IPCC, and I cannot imagine that position shifting. So you could do it, would be a really good thing, but it wouldn't have any official standing. And they might say they didn't want the IPCC to do it because it might be seen as having official standing. So.
We maybe have one last question and then...
Just at the very back.
The very back, please.
You are the very back, sir.
Yeah, I am. with regard to the relationship with the United States and our representative on these IPCC, I expected a 180-degree shift from the change in administration. Did that happen?
Oh, No. But I'll tell you something that will make you go home feeling more positive about the United States and its role in climate change. The IPCC could not operate without the United States of America. Now, one of the reasons for that is very crude, in that the United States is the paymaster for the IPCC. It makes the largest financial contribution. But it goes deeper than that. When we do the review process for the chapters in the IPCC, by far the most rigorous process of review, the most systematic and the most useful process of review is carried out by the United States government, which gathers together scientists into committees, one for each chapter, brings them to meetings, gets them to read the chapter, produce a whole of committee set of review comments, and then packs those off to the technical support unit to be transmitted to the chapter authors. And that's by far the most rigorous and useful set of comments that the IPCC receives. So I hope that makes you feel better about the whole thing. It should.
So let's just thank Gene one more time.